My friends, hello, how are you? My name is Ben Tartine, and this is the podcast for Colossae East. So we've got it set up for this small church community meeting here in the east side of Portland. So the same welcome for all the friends and neighbors, everybody from around here in Portland who's listening. I hope that you're doing well and miss you. What times? So welcome to you. And then equally warm is the welcome to everybody who's beyond Portland, out in the rest of the country and even beyond. It is good to be with you. And every week we follow the Revised Common Lectionary's dedicated gospel passage for the coming Sunday. So for this week, we're on the fifth Sunday after the Epiphany, and our gospel passage will be Mark 1, 29-39. So each week as we set out into these biblical texts and stories, you know, we shift, I don't know if you shift down or shift up, but we set the gear shift for the thinking gear of our soul and press on into the world created by Jesus, by his true words. You like that? I like those words. I think that's a good way to put it. We're pressing on into this world created by Jesus's true words. And there's kind of a double entendre there, you know, because he created the world with his words to begin with. But it's like this kingdom conversation we've been having for months now through the lens of Jesus is so much about this recreation, this renewal, or he's inviting us into this new world. You know, remember the whole Moses? Okay, I'm getting off track. We haven't even started. So I'm going to be thinking about this with, I'm in my backyard tool shed next to my lawnmower and a bunch of hand tools. And I'm not sure where you're at, but together we're going to think about this Jesus, okay? That's the plan. We do every week. That's all we do here. last week, we were in the scene at the synagogue in Capernaum, and we're going to be in the same scene this week, but later on, after that one. Same day, though. And before we get there, I want to set it up as we often do, and I'm going to start with an image about evil. If you remember last week, we had lots of discussion about evil spirits and the sort of evil spiritual world that's corrupting and cursing human beings. Well, we're certainly going to be in that same vein today, but I find often that we don't quite, well, we certainly don't all think the same thing when we try to understand evil. And one of the big mistakes that we have is that evil has substance or evil has purpose. I know that might even ruffle some feathers hearing it said that way, but bear with me for a second. Let me take you to a moment where my wife, Allie, and I are walking around together in Tel Aviv, Israel in the afternoon. And we're taking pictures and, you know, walking alongside the river, and it's really cool. When we come down closer to the ocean, we see this beautiful wall that's a painting. And it's like this multifaceted, super colorful, kind of splatter painted, wild, abstract looking thing that also has really bold, blocky letters that are somehow masked and very visible through all of the color splashing. And the big word across the wall, and it says just as bold as can be, together. So just imagine a giant, beautiful, perfectly smooth wall with these vibrant colors splashed all over, and yet the word together just boldly visible right across the middle. Okay? Now, just think about that as the good. This is the good creation, if you will. God will say it is tov. It is good. And now imagine somebody coming by with a sledgehammer and absolutely destroying a hole, 2 foot big, huge hole in the side of this wall. And I want to say to you, that is a picture of evil. But think about it this way. Does the hole exist? Yes, you know, it does in a sense, but the hole in itself is the corruption of the wall. It's the detraction from or the taking away from the goodness of the wall, the together wall, if you will. So think of evil that way. It is something in the created world of God that is destroying his creation. Or perhaps it's even better to say, if God created something, it exists. And if it's taking away from that existence, then by definition, it's non-existence, or it's the corruption of existence. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds there, but I think it's really important because it helps us understand what Jesus is doing in the world. The long-awaited promise is that God will restore his creation. And all of the corruption and brokenness has led to tremendous toil and suffering and all of that. So evil in the world is always that force that's destroying, taking away from, corrupting, consuming God's creation, just like a sledgehammer coming to bash through a perfect, beautiful wall. And it is violent and brutal, and it exists in that sense. Like, everybody's going to look in the world and say, yeah, I see that a lot of evil exists. But what you see is actually the absence of goodness, just like you would see a hole bashed through a wall. Yes, the hole's there, but in and of itself, it's what we call in Christian teaching a privation, a subtraction from. All right, now, that's deeply important, this understanding of sin and evil or brokenness, if we're going to understand what Jesus is doing in terms of salvation. So often salvation gets just really tersely pitched as, am I going to heaven or hell? Well, that's not the way that the Bible reads. It was a really good way for a really long time to scare people into making a fast decision. But when you get into the deep story of the scripture, you're talking about a major breakdown of goodness. I mean, sledgehammer crazy for thousands of years. And then the story of Jesus, who's coming to begin that total renewal work. The goodness that's getting destroyed is going to be healed and solved and fixed by God. He always has been inviting people, his people, into that kind of work. He'll say right out of Genesis 12, you know, when he calls Abraham to be his people, he's like, I want you to be my people, and I'm going to bless you for one major reason, so that you can serve, so you can bless the nations around you. This has always been the heart of God. And that's been lost, I think, along the way. I certainly wasn't trained to see God as this loving restorer whose major mission in all of his eternal life was to create and love and build goodness into the world. You know, I got this way more kind of unknowable, really distant, ultra-sovereign, powerful God who didn't really like me that much and was always disappointed with me. And then maybe later on in the future, he would hopefully like me when he made me better, however I needed, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, well, Jesus just doesn't roll that way. And when you get into the story of the scriptures for real, it just doesn't talk that way. So we sometimes see this desire to heal, and then we jump in and we can heal ourselves. This world's authorities keep teaching us that we can solve the great problems we have with an equal greatness, even greater plans, better cities, greater rules, more significant things, and faster, more efficient ways of renewing and change. We can do it. And I'm hoping that when we go through this text today, that you'll be able to see it's actually quite the opposite. He is the greatest of all human beings, so I will grant you that. But it is anything but great in terms of what this world is going to recognize. He does everything wrong. Everything. And in the eyes of a certain kind of person and a certain kind of authority in the culture and in the world. And that has been what we've been exploring for some time. And he doesn't achieve much change. I've talked about that a lot. He doesn't get famous for a good reason. And just let that sink in for a second, because I have grown up in a church world that has very much wanted to be famous for a good reason. And it might sound similar, but wanting to be famous for a good reason is very different than wanting to be good. whether fame comes or not. And there is where I think you see Jesus operating. He is, what matters most to him is goodness. He's restoring those holes that have been bashed through the good creation that God made. So I'm going to put forth an attempt to show here that what Jesus is doing is actually not a way of showing great power or his greatness in any way, and he wasn't seeking that at all. And instead, what he's doing is ordinary work. It's not very amazing in and of itself in his context. It's the way he was doing it, which we looked at last week too. Remember how he was teaching not like the experts, but as one who had authority in himself? So the way he did it was what was so amazing. It wasn't the teaching of it itself. Remember, that was last week. Mark didn't even tell us what he taught. So there was that. Here, because we don't live from that day or that context, I think we kind of take it in differently. It's not super abrasive to us because it's all so distant to us. And so we just tend to think that this is crazy, extraordinary work, but it's really not that. It's the it's the days he's doing it on. It's the people he's doing it with. It's the cities that he's showing up in and the way he's presenting. All of it is like a symbolic, direct teaching about the system itself. Okay? So his ordinary acts of service are super duper powerful. And the idea that he always seems to be teaching is that these ways of life that I'm showing you, he says to his followers, these are going to restore every sledgehammer hole that's been broken out of this world with lies and abuse and injustice and theft and murder and rape and every possible crime that happens to humanity. God's restoring all of that, and this is how he's going to do it. And we have a million questions like, well, what about those people? And how? And he says, trust me, I'm full with love, and everybody receives it, and nothing can separate human beings from my love. So here we go. Trust me, we're together. We're this team, okay? So he's teaching us that. I'm getting ahead of myself. I want to say it's like the work of Jesus is not only counteracting the work of that evil sledgehammer. I think we've seen a lot of that through history, patching up holes and painting back over it, and then only later a whole nother warrior clan comes along and smashes another one. Well, he's not just patching it up. He's the promise of the scriptures of the Old Testament is that this Messiah would stop it permanently. And disease and sickness and falsehood, one evil spirit at a time. So it might be slow, but this work of Jesus is also irreversible. Once real love and true words take root, it's only going to be a matter of time. And that's Jesus. Real love, the most true love any human has ever lived in or seen, and true words. In him, no deceit was found, you know? He was completely true in everything that he said and taught. And it's like that root took hold in the early first century, and it's just a matter of time. As people come and see him and start to embrace this way, a very humble and patient way, it's like that is what full people who are healed in that way are permanently healed and will continue to be healed. And when I say permanently, I don't hear me say that your cancer is never going to come back. It's not that kind of thing at all. It's the deep healing of the human brokenness that as you are set free from those lies that have crippled you, it's like as the voice of Jesus silences them, it's a powerful and permanent silence. And if it's not permanent right now in your life as you live and walk with Jesus, the promise is that it will be. Just don't give up. Don't turn away from him. It's never a momentary, it's all magically gone away. Although, even as I say that, we're looking at a passage where sicknesses are magically, in the sense, momentarily, immediately healed. Even still, those people who are healed will die and go to a grave. So it wasn't a permanent healing, was it? Okay, let's start with the question, all right? And then we'll go right into the text. What do you think when you hear a story about a day in the life of so and so. Okay, somebody's going to set up a story. The author says, let me tell you about a day in the life of whoever. What's the author trying to do there? Well, he or she's probably not trying to give you a comprehensive picture of so-and-so's entire life history and all the major details. Yeah, I think it's more like a, if you want to get an average picture of what's usually going on in this person's life, here's a little snippet snapshot. I think that's what Mark is doing here for us in the two passages we last week's in this. He's giving us a pretty nice literary day in the life of Jesus. And I say that because it sort of starts and ends Sabbath. That's where the big work is happening. And you have this really interesting normality to it. Normal in the sense of he's not trying to show us the first major moments in a huge chronological history. Instead, it's a snippet snapshot of something that was going on for a long time. You know, okay. I think it sounds nice, and I think folks like us could agree with that, but we have a very, very hard time thinking that this wasn't some sort of particularly wonderful picture of Jesus's greatness. So I've been harping on that. Here's the two big reasons, and this will be how we break down the rest of our episode here. The two big reasons, I think, is that Jesus is already an internationally, globally famous word in our modern world. It's almost impossible to imagine that he's just a nobody who's not very desirable. But in our story, that's what he is, deeply. So that's important. Second, we're good Americans and don't generally get what Sabbath is all about. We tend to imagine it as a weekly gift from God. If in our Christian sort of pop Christian mindset, we think of it as a gift from God that he gives to us for rest and renewal, connection with him. Sometimes we add worship in and we say that's a day that we give to him for our own goodness and so forth. And I think all of that is true in a sense, but there's something much deeper about Sabbath that I'm pretty sure I certainly was never taught in a lot of different church life, and I think we miss it. So I want to talk about that, and I think when we see that, it really makes the story pop here, okay? So that's the two main things. We're going to sort of break down that greatness theme, and then I want to talk deep about the Sabbath theme. Let's recap Mark 1, where we've been, and then we'll come to Mark 1, 29 through 39. That's where we'll be. So Mark opens with John the Baptizer, if you remember, right in chapter 1. And I think we said, and we can certainly say again, it sort of marks the beginning of the end time. As you read the whole gospel, that's what you pick up. Whoa, this is the beginning of the end, the last days, the final promised rest or shalom that God has promised, where the Messiah would arrive and blast out all of evil and create, or let's say renew, his creation to its tov state. You know, where people could finally be free. So Jesus shows up early part of the chapter, and John the Baptist, he's like, see, told you, he's here, boom. So then Jesus gets baptized. Then we talked at length in that episode. It was titled Baptized Into What? And we noticed that by getting baptized, Jesus himself is leading a group of human beings, you and me, his disciples, all who will follow him, through the waters, and into this long-promised new world, just like Moses led his captives from slavery and death into their free promised world after going through the waters of the Red Sea. And then they headed into this new promised world of freedom. Okay, so in both cases, they were led by God. First, you know, back in the day, it was God present in the pillar of the smoke and fire. Notice that's a directional. He shows you where to go. Now it seems to be, or not seems to be, it certainly is, according to Christian teaching, this is God himself showing us not just the way to get somewhere, but how to be. The way to truly be human in the tov way, the good way that God created us to be in. So as Jesus is teaching us how to be human, notice he's repairing what was damaged inside of us, telling the voice of the Satan to be silent, teaching us how to be at peace with who we are, who others are, and who God is. You know, that's a beautiful healing. The way to truly be human. Okay, so then he goes, this is the brief recap, look at me go. Then he goes on a walkabout for 40 days. We did not spend time in that story in this podcast. Maybe we can come back to it later. But he goes for 40 days and he's tempted really viciously by Satan. And a major scene is set in that moment. Mark is showing us, you know, if this is truly the long-awaited time for the king to come and for God's kingdom to start ruling, then Satan will be we're going to have to deal directly head-on with Satan. And in this scene, Jesus didn't kill him or even really fight him. He does two things with Satan. One, he speaks true words to him. And two, he rejects that voice tempting him to trust the way of greatness. Go back and read that story and you'll see the big temptation is you can be great. I will show you how and can grant it. And Jesus has that moment where it's like, I can. And no, I'm going to trust the eternal way, which is the love of Father, Son, and Spirit. That's how anything was created in the first. That's where power is. So but that scene was a solid victory. You know, he stays true to what is tov, what is good. And the 40-day temptation, it kind of ends up reading like a first miracle, you know. I mean, it's not technically, but it kind of looks that way. It's a really good story. So then Jesus packs a bag and we're backpacking around the Galilean North Shore. And so 2 weeks ago, we were in Mark 1, 16 through 19, and we see this unique invitation that he gives to several fishermen. He says, come and follow after me. Come and see me. It's not do this or die, or you guys are so dumb. You should believe these facts instead, you know. I've got better information for you than you have. It's not that. He says, come and see. And it's come and see what I'm saying and doing and how I'm living. They do. They instinctively invite others to do the same. And the idea we really thought about was the truth speaks for itself. Last week, then, he started this day in the life of Jesus scene that we're in today in the synagogue. We went deep into the demonic or the evil spirits. So there's a lot happening, and a lot of it is pretty mysterious. And remember, this is the God's final declaration of final war on evil, like the war to end all wars, which is why it's mysterious, because it looks like a war that's waged with humble love and service, which does not feel like war. But maybe, just maybe, that teaches us a little bit. It teaches us to wonder who it is we're really fighting. Because if the war to end all wars begins with true words and a humble invitation into healing in real life, an invitation to all humanity for that same thing, that tells us something about who Jesus is fighting, you know? I want to just keep saying this. The apostles will say it's not against flesh and blood that we fight. Jesus says we love and forgive and serve and help our enemies. We see humanity as the brothers and sisters God gave us, whom we've been given to bring tov, goodness to, and them to us. The idea is we will all learn to live in this way. And so that's the war. That's the big move. And it's just baffling. It's not what you're expecting. Okay. Well, here we are, Mark 1:29, and I'll read from the New Living Translation. Verse 29. After Jesus left the synagogue with James and John, they went to Simon and Andrew's home. Now Simon's mother-in-law was sick in bed with a high fever. They told Jesus about her right away. So he went to her bedside, took her by the hand, and helped her sit up. Then the fever left her, and she prepared a meal for them. That evening after sunset, Many sick and demon-possessed people were brought to Jesus. The whole town gathered at the door to watch. So Jesus healed many people who were sick with various diseases, and he cast out many demons. But because the demons knew who he was, he did not allow them to speak. Before daybreak the next morning, Jesus got up and went out to an isolated place to pray. Later, Simon and the others went out to find him. When they found him, they said, "Everybody's looking for you." But Jesus replied, this is verse 38, "We must go on to other towns as well, and I will preach to them too. That is why I came." So he traveled throughout the region of Galilee, preaching in the synagogues and casting out demons. This is the gospel. Thanks be to God. Preaching in the synagogues and casting out the demons, silencing the cursed voices. Isn't that great? Remember from last week that we talked about how that would have been pretty normal. We're still before the time when they have to button down the synagogue pulpit, if you will, and then they'll require some ordination and they have to be more officially authorized to teach. So they had teachers like this come in, and Jesus was, it was the perfect moment in history to do a whole lot of teaching from a place where people came to learn and hear about the scriptures. Okay. So here's the question I want to start with. Do you get the impression from this passage that Jesus is doing something significant or insignificant? It's significant. Yeah. Healing sicknesses, healing diseases, doing away with demons that have been destroying and deceiving human beings for ages. So yeah, this is a big deal. Just earlier this same day, so that's last week's episode, we see the statement from Mark about the crowd's reaction. Verse 27, amazement gripped the audience. They asked excitedly, and you know, it said, the news about Jesus spread quickly throughout the entire region of Galilee. So when I see those kinds of words, it's like, whoa, something really awesome and exciting and big is going on. And then in what we just read, we see his friends saying, come on, everybody, everybody, or no, not come on, everybody, but come on, Jesus, everybody's looking for you. And I think that conveys a sense of popularity. So from my modern, church angle, if you will, the sort of pop culture church angle, this looks like the beginnings of a great leader who does great things and gets huge results. You know, he's coming in, he's doing a big service project, people are gathered around, he's teaching masses. And so we sort of conclude, well, if the church was also able to, or gosh, would be willing to, or just have enough faith for once, then we also would be doing these big things. And we really could accomplish that huge, big stuff. And I hear so much conversation about it. And if we're not, sometimes if we're not, it is because we have our heart turned away from Jesus. Sometimes it's because we're living the actual life of Jesus, and ordinary, restful things that heal just don't get a lot of press. But we start to think, when we think of it as this famous moment, we too could achieve this kind of fame. And then it would all be for a good cause, of course, because it would be a righteous and wonderful ministry of God. Just look at Jesus's success here. But at this point, I'm pretty prepared to say that nothing like that kind of greatness is happening. Remember last week how we talked about the two different ways of being, utterly amazed or shocked? That language of the people's reaction to Jesus is that they were amazed. They were totally shocked, utterly amazed. Well, there's one way to that. So that's a big statement, but there's two different ways to do that. One is like, wow, look at this new cell phone. It's so amazing. How does it do that? Those pictures, the features, The other kind of amazement was like, I think the image was, if you're sitting on a beach wearing flip-flops and a tank top and you're probably drinking a Corona, well, I don't know. You're probably, is anybody ever going to drink a Corona again? I don't know. Probably that poor beer company, what a year. Anyway, you're sitting on the beach and then a Category 4 hurricane whips up and is barreling straight at your face and you're amazed. but you're more like, what is about to happen? You know, oh my gosh, this is. And so it's that, maybe not quite as terrifying, but definitely amazed at, like, this is powerful and what's about to happen next. That's very different than the first kind. Okay, so Jesus was certainly amazing, but more amazing like that hurricane, not like a cell phone. And I think there's the first way we see that it's really not a story about popularity gain. Just in the way that Mark uses those words, they were amazed. They were amazed in the way Mark used that word in his context, both in the Bible and his world, which was a sense of deep, oh my gosh, something is being heavily disrupted here. Very, very similar to what you felt when you saw the people marching on the Capitol this year on the 6th. You were amazed. And it was because a sacred space, I'll put quotes around that, sacred space was being invaded. What was happening in that place was the total disruption of the social order. And so you're like, what is about to happen next? Okay, that is a really, I think that's a great way to talk about how Mark had said it. So right away, it's not like, ooh, wow. Okay. And then here's the next part. We're told that he's doing this stuff on the Sabbath day. And so in our modern church sort of American response is like, oh, that's nice. He's doing good works on the Lord's day. It kind of warms my heart. But if you're actually a first century person in Capernaum, you know, or if you're one of those early readers of Mark's gospel, you're like, what the hell is this guy doing? Why does he think he can do? Who in the world? And so why? Are you freaking out like this? Why are you so shocked? It's because you've heard him teaching as a Jewish leader in the synagogue, and he is Jewish himself. So you're hearing about a person who's becoming known in the Jewish world who's not submitting to the Jewish way that you've been taught. It's like a contradiction. It's like somebody on Facebook telling you about how bad Facebook is by posting about it on Facebook. Or like a Pepsi fanatic who only drinks Coke, you know? It's like, that makes no sense. How could a Jewish teacher with authority like this and power like this also not follow synagogue and Sabbath custom? And as a man, going to a sick woman on the Sabbath day? I don't think so. That's just not right. But you've known how sick she's been, really bad, and you hear that she's healed completely, totally restored, good, you know, tov to go, good to go. I wonder if some of the people could immediately see that even though he's not following the correct social order, when you see him, you can't deny that he's bringing life to people, real healing. Surely many started to rethink their priorities. You know, they all believed that goodness matters. For sure it does. But in this case, goodness did not matter as much as following the right social order. In their world, goodness is like, that's nice if you can get there, but there's a lot of necessary evil. It's just stuff you got to do to get ahead. A lot of it is destructive. A lot of it to stay safe. Sorry, it's just the way the world works, we say. Yeah, and Jesus is like, yeah, that's exactly right. Now let's look at how the kingdom works. To Jesus, goodness matters most. Nothing at all matters more to him than living in the goodness of God. And then you meet Jesus. And his way of ordinary appears to be somehow receiving the divine life in our presence. Like Jesus is a place where the creating, healing, good life of God is flowing. Well, that's what people were talking about big time, is this, yes, he's doing these actions that are powerful, but I think we sometimes think that that was really unique back then, and it wasn't unique at all back then. You had all kinds of people going around doing exorcisms and the mystical healings and that kind of thing. I'm not saying that they were all real, but there was tons of chatter about that kind of stuff. Remember last week how we talked so about how widespread the Jewish beliefs in this day were about unclean spirits, how pervasive they were throughout everything, different times of day, etc., etc.? Well, accompanying all of that is also a whole bunch of folks who have some sort of remedy and authority they're claiming can help bring people to healing. So within your own region, many healers and healing practices have been popular, and you've heard them talk about, oh, did you hear about that guy? Yeah, I heard he can do this. I heard they did that. Wow, you know. One of the ways of dealing with this burning fever, so that's what the Talmud calls what Peter's mother-in-law has. Think that burning fever is a longer, more disease kind of idea, not just like a COVID response. And so it was to, one of the ways to deal with it was you would tie a knife entirely made of iron to a thorn bush with a braid of hair, and then repeat reading three Exodus passages over and over until the fever broke. And sometimes it worked, and sometimes, as you expect, it didn't. William Barclay writes, there were many exorcists in the time of Jesus, but they worked with elaborate incantations and formula and spells and magical apparatus. If I'm hearing about a healer, you know, as a guy who's living back then, my point is, it's certainly not the first time that I've heard of that. That's not the thing that impresses me or wows me. And if somebody says, well, yeah, but this guy's legit, he's not like all the other ones, I've certainly heard that before, you know, probably from all of them. But then when my buddy Joe sits down at the coffee shop and he's carrying on about this Jesus guy and all this cool whatever, and Joe says, and he did the demon thing and the fever thing both on the Sabbath day. Now you've got my attention. That's where my first century Jewish heart skips a beat and I stop texting on my phone and I look up at you with wide open eyes and I'm really paying attention. Okay, Joe, say that again. What was that? I'm telling you, like I said, dude rolls into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and teaches with authority, and it's not like the expert's authority at all. It's his own. He's quoting nobody. He never mentions a single freaking rabbi. And then, first thing he does, a demon shows up in the synagogue, no less, and boom, dude throws it out by saying three words, silence, go away. And that was that. And the guy was renewed right there in the synagogue, right there on the Sabbath, no joke. You know, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, are you joking? The Sabbath day? Yeah, and the healing thing too, right after he goes over to her house, the dude, Simon or whatever, the fisher guy, his mom or his mother-in-law or sister, I don't know who it was, somebody was sick, and Jesus went over there and he healed her. Are you sure it was a woman? Yeah, man, mothers-in-law tend to be women. I know it was a woman. You're right. This is nuts, Joe. You know, I would be at that moment totally flabbergasted, not so much about the powerful things I had heard him do, though those are like foundational critical, so they are totally critical. But the thing that wows me in this context is the social order that he's disrupting. It's really important to go to Peter's mother-in-law's bedside, to hold her hand, to lift her up out of her sickness. That's a big deal. But to do it as a Jewish male teacher on the Sabbath day, oh my goodness. You've just disrupted the way things work in the world between human beings. Nothing is more miraculous than that. My point is, the things he's doing are fairly normal in the day, but it's the disruption of the social order. And that's what the gospel writers are so stoked about. And like, that's the dramatic thing. And for my whole life, I was taught to just see his miraculous power proves he's God. And then he dies for your sins. All done, you know. And seeing it in their context is so much better and richer. And I think truer, because it's more Jesus. This same exact idea is not just in the New Testament. Think about the picture of Pharaoh, the Hebrew people, and Moses way back in the Exodus, right? When you think about them, you realize that the big story that gets repeated for generation to generation is not a careful recounting of every single one of the 10 plagues. even though that's in tradition and it's part of all of that, the big core of it is what he did, which is he pulled us up from out of slavery and death in Egypt. He completely shut down the social order that enslaves and kills us. And he brought us into a new world. That was the miracle of the whole Exodus story. That's the miracle that's happening as Jesus hits these synagogues and heals people on the Sabbath day. I see the same idea deeply embedded in this way that he's choosing the Sabbath to do that. You'll see it. Keep reading through Mark. Read all the way. Mark's not a very long book. Read through it and see how often his healing acts and his other miracles happen on the Sabbath day. You'll be smiling by the end. Loving one another matters more than any requirement. We see that in Jesus. But what if following God's law means that women who are suffering in disease cannot be helped by men during the time between sundown on Fridays and sundown on Saturdays? They'll just have to wait because, as the social culture agrees, making her wait, that honors God's law, right? She needs to submit to that. That's the way to honor. And Jesus is like, that honors nothing good. That's insane. All of God's law leads to goodness and to life. So helping a woman find healing on any day is a good thing. You'll see him get into trouble one Sabbath day after another. I'm telling you. And they say, you can't do it right now. And he says, yes, the time of daily, endless goodness has come. Let's start now. I kind of had an epiphany when I was studying this passage earlier this week. Think about it this way. None of God's requirements for human beings, not one of his commands, not one demand, not one instruction, none of them, if you hear him and follow what he's saying, not one, will guide you to an unloving action or thought. Not one. And it's like Jesus is saying, I came to restore the good, and I do the works the Father gave me, which are all good, especially on the Sabbath. To Jesus, goodness matters more than anything else. And so, hopefully, by sitting in that context with me, you can start to see that it wasn't a pursuit of greatness at all, quite the opposite. He was quite disruptive socially, you know, perhaps great in that way you don't want to be great for. And in the work he's doing is ordinary in the life of Jesus and his friends, and they're pursuing tov, not greatness, but goodness. And it mattered more than customs, more than restrictions or social norms or what was okay versus taboo or any of that. What matters most to Jesus is goodness. That's above it all. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, we miss the whole point if we're presupposing that Jesus is seeking greatness. But we also miss the point if we think that Sabbath is merely a weekly resting day for your work, for toil. Like it's a gift of relaxation once a week. I think it is that. So I'm not saying don't think that. That's wrong. I think that's definitely part of it. It renews your body and soul. But it's deeper than that in terms of what God meant for it. And I think in terms of what the Jewish culture understood its meaning to be. And I don't want to say Jewish culture too broadly, because that's the sort of debate you see at play here. There's plenty of people who understand they're being oppressed because life is really brutal under some of that stuff. But in general, I think the heart of the law for Sabbath following is to give God's people a taste of what his final rest will be in an eternal sense. So we're going to flesh that out here. But first, soak in this scene one more time out of Mark chapter 1. We'll start in verse 30 this time. Simon's mother-in-law was sick in bed with a high fever. They told Jesus about her right away, so he went to her bedside, took her by the hand, and helped her sit up. Then the fever left her, and she prepared a meal for them. Verse 32. That evening, after sunset, many sick and demon-possessed people were brought to Jesus. The whole town gathered at the door to watch. So Jesus healed many people who were sick with various diseases, and he cast out many demons, evil spirits. So, interesting, isn't it? Why are they waiting until sunset to come out? And I think it was because they're prohibited from carrying any burden through town on the Sabbath day. That's one of the major rules. And that ends at sundown on Saturday. So here's Jesus having violated the Sabbath, but with some really noteworthy healing that came out of his violating of God's law. You know, people are doing a double take on that. How could that be happening if he's outside of God's law? But notice the constraint still put on them. As excited as they might be, they don't want to break the Sabbath rules. They know that to get over there, they got to wait till sundown because they're going to try to carry a burden through town. And that's, you know, if you've got a disease or you're sick or you're plagued by demons, I think the interpretation had been along those lines. Don't bring that through town on the Sabbath day. So based on what they've heard and seen, they're wanting to engage with Jesus, but somehow they're still locked into this system. And it's really a beautiful kind of moment, because if you've ever felt locked into a system and you can't really pursue the goodness in life that you really want to pursue, you know, because it's just not allowed, it's just not the way things work, just try to imagine yourself in these shoes. You've got a sickness that's been racking you for years, and you find out that he's in town and you want to go see him, but you really can't because of the way the system works. It just kind of seems, we can't read too much into this, but I think there's a good example to catch. And it's that when your life is broken beyond repair, and there's this, maybe it's a voice that says you're not enough, you're unclean, you're dirty, you're low, you're less. You know, that demonic voice of corruption, like a sledgehammer that bashes holes through the goodness that God made you into. Maybe we can see this move of those who heard about Jesus as a good example for us. Because even in their context with its, let's call it systemic injustice, and a ruling class that held people in a very odd and broken and very damaging place, the move they still make is to go to Jesus for healing. So the big break that you see here, even if you still see people trapped in a system, if you will, they're focused on Jesus and they're going to him for healing in the best way they know how. Maybe other kinds of healing exist in a way, but that deep permanent healing seems to come from Jesus alone. Because as we keep saying, this was not about healing alone in terms of a temporal relief, but about the permanent healing of the entire world. I think that's the big part of the spiritual casting out of demons for the mindset of people first seeing and hearing this. You know, it's like when you start throwing the Satan out of this creation, out of this world, that's when we don't just have the healing of a fever and then we still end up in a grave later. When you throw the destroyer and the adversary out of this world, that's when we never, ever go to a grave again. So now we're getting into this deeper meaning of Sabbath, because here's Jesus bringing renewal in a permanent way by casting out demons. People are seeing that part as unique in the way he's doing it again. Here are some words from Ben Witherington that I think really capture this whole idea so well. And we refer to him once in a while on this podcast because he's just a great New Testament scholar, and I love his writing is often very clear and helpful for me. So here's what he has to say about the Sabbath. This healing, like the exorcist, so he's talking about the healing of Peter's mother-in-law by Jesus, like the exorcism, takes place on the Sabbath day. And it is important to understand the theology of the Sabbath in Jesus's day. The Sabbath had become a symbol of the eschatological rest, or shalom, that God would one day provide for his people when, as the Pharisees thought, the Messiah came and brought in the age to come. The longed-for Sabbath was the coming of the dominion of God. Thus, Jesus is beginning his healing work on the Sabbath should be seen as a deliberate attempt to bring in that final Sabbath rest, a time when creation would be relieved not just from the turmoil and toil of a fallen world, but also from disease, decay, and death. From this perspective, there was no better time to heal a person than on the Sabbath as an indicator that the ultimate Sabbath was coming. Okay? Isn't that beautiful? I think that's exactly what we've been trying to see here and lead up to that idea. When we just see the Sabbath as a nice weekly rest, we miss a lot in this passage. When you can sit in the context of their day and understand that it has become a symbol for the eschatological rest or shalom that God would bring. Now, eschatological, that's a big word. Think eschaton or the end of time. So the end that God would finally bring to sin and brokenness and evil and bring his kingdom, this age to come. So as a Hebrew back in the day or a Jewish person in Jesus's day and still today, the practice of observing a weekly Sabbath is a way to join into the goodness of the age to come. The rule or the dominion of God when he's truly king over all. He is truly king over all. Not all recognize that yet. And that's okay. He's bringing us along. Each as we come and see him. So, when you hear about Jesus doing his work, and specifically this kind of renewing, restoring work of telling the truth and healing people, and you hear about him doing it on the Sabbath day, you know, just like our buddy Joe was telling us at the coffee shop, right? We know something very powerful and symbolic is happening. Okay, so before we noticed with that other fictional anecdote, the craziness of the disruption of the social order, it also has the deeper meaning of, whoa, he's actually talking about the final rest starting in what he's doing. You know, is this man from Nazareth attempting to bring in that final Sabbath rest? A time when creation finds total relief? A total renewal of everything that was bashed out of it with a sledgehammer? You know, goodness seems to be returning through this man's work in the world, we might say, through his unending and never limited love. A love that has authority over every social structure we create. Think about that. Think about how many times the social structures we create give us a freedom or a license to be unloving. Sorry, it's just business. That's just the way it is. Yep, that's how our policy reads. Yep, that, right? Think about how many human beings get harmed under the ideas of simple laws and protocols and procedures that just have to be that way. The social structures we create are built far more in terms of staying protected, great, and surviving another day. The way of love, which is unending and never limited, that's the way of Father, Son, and Spirit. That's the fiber of creation that God breathed us all into existence with. Because here's the deal. If you're watching Jesus and you're offended by his violation of the Sabbath rules because you think he's violating God's law, then you've been mistaught to think that your national laws are of God. Of course, I'm speaking about back in that day, right? If they're upset that he's violating God's law, they don't know what God's law even means. I think U.S. citizens of all walks suffer from a similar disease, myself included. I was definitely taught to see the way of America as of God. Oh my goodness, in all of the ways it powers up over and enslaves and forces and demands and threatens with violence and war. I don't know how of God it is the longer I live. I don't know that any human created empire ever is. Perhaps that's why Jesus says they'll all end. You know, maybe he's also saying, yeah. Yeah, there won't be a king you guys can ever live under who rules over you, who's going to rule you the way I do. Because I rule you with ever-living, never-ending love. Here's Witherington's second thought, same subject. Yet unfortunately, what Jesus did would be seen and was seen as a violation of the Sabbath, indeed as work on the Sabbath. Such a response to Jesus' miracle reflects a failure to understand what the Sabbath is for, to give persons rest from what ails them or wearies them, as well as the further failure to recognize that the Lord of the Sabbath was in their midst, the one who had authority and power to bring in the Sabbath rest. So if you think what Jesus is doing on the Sabbath is bad, you know, Witherington is saying, then you still haven't learned about the Sabbath. And this was meant to be a time to give rest from what ails and corrupts and consumes and sledgehammers us, you know? And it always has been, and it always points to the final world that will be nothing like the rest of this world has been. And not just for one day, but for every day. It's like the whole practice of observing the Sabbath was meant to train the human mind and the heart to become people who love healing, people who love helping one another become more alive, and who live like Jesus with hope for a final enduring shalom, a peace among all people, with each other and with God. The practice of observing the Sabbath was meant to train us and form us into people who want to live in peace with everybody. You can imagine a neighborhood filled with God's people all really practicing a way of shalom, where all is about sharing, never hoarding. All is about living as mutuals, helping and loving. That is a beautiful picture of human flourishing. So you see what's happening then? Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law in a relatively non-dramatic way. We talked a lot about that already. This is in a living room with a handful of people. He doesn't need a big audience or approval or the favor of the crowds to do his work. He doesn't even need to be seen. He just does this kind of thing wherever he goes. You'll see it wherever he goes. Sometimes it'll be one person along the way. Others, it'll be whole groups of people. And he's teaching his followers to do the same, and he's offering healing. And so that's valuable. So people do start to gather. But again, we could start to think that, oh, he's becoming popular or big. And it's Mark is, I think, effectively showing us that becoming great is just not Jesus's goal. That goal is ordinary love for all, wherever we go, whatever day it is. Good matters most. So Jesus heals her in the living room. And then we read this. I just love that picture of how humble it is. And then we read this, verse 35. Before daybreak the next morning, Jesus got up and he went out to an isolated place to pray. Later, Simon and the others went out to find him. When they found him, they said, "Everyone's looking for you." And I think that statement conveys a little bit of like, what are you doing out here, man? This is our shot. But Jesus replied, "We must go on to other towns as well, and I will preach to them too. That is why I came." So he traveled throughout the region of Galilee, preaching in the synagogues and casting out demons. And there it is again, right when you'd expect the traveling exorcist or this itinerant preacher to seek the crowd to make himself known. Instead, you see Jesus withdraw into a quiet, private space to pray. This way of living is constantly seen through his life. Again, read through Mark, read the whole Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You'll see this ebb and flow of his movement from public engagement followed by withdrawal to solitude. Not isolation, but solitude. It's with God. It's like he's never, ever seeking the spotlight. Notice how he even works with this power in a way that it's always displayed in the victim he's healing, not in himself. No crazy big drawing of attention to himself in any kind of way. Everybody in the room is looking at the person who was sick and seeing the healing come. And then when people do say, "Ooh, you're so great, you're so powerful, you're like a new phone," you know, he always says, "No, I am not, that I'm doing what the Father gave me to do, and it's his power doing it." So he's never seeking glory or recognition or fame at all, ever. He's never trying to get a press release or a video clip that shows the good work he's done in town. He's never posting things. He's never showing people how humble he is or how great he is in a way to draw attention to himself. He lives that way. People do pay attention. We read about that. But in all of the stories, including this one, we have to grab onto that sense of his way is about ordinary rest, renewal for ordinary life, which is the receptacle of the divine. The ordinary life is where the divine life meets and flows in this world. Dallas Willard said that. I'll read it in a second. Right in verse 38, when the disciples announce this big opportunity to make a big splash, everybody's looking for you, Jesus. You might say, yes, it's working. They're gathering. It's our cultural moment. Instead, he says, this is never about an event or a moment or anything like that. What matters most is good. We must go on to other towns as well. It's not just about Capernaum. It's not just about any particular spot, person, people group. I'm going indiscriminately around this region, and I'm going to preach to them as well. This is why I came. So he traveled throughout the region of Galilee. Not wealthy, not a popular people, no warriors or politicians or the elite. It's farm country, fishing country. And why go there? Because they're people, and he wants to tell them the truth and bring healing and to preach. Bringing in that eternal rest of God, which the Sabbath tradition has long anticipated, will come about not through war against human beings or a new way to control people with better coercion or law. The long anticipated Sabbath ultimate, right? In every day, in every way, shalom and peace. That's going to come through a loving invitation to hear and consider what is true. And to live into it, of course. So his weapon is true words and healing and silencing the cursed voices in people. You seeing it emerging? Remember how amazed everybody was with the demon casting out scene? He did such good work simply through what? Speaking true words. That was the emphasis. The whole story tells us more and more as we ponder it, doesn't it? We've said it often. The story shows Jesus declaring God's war against evil. And apparently, what we see him doing, this is how he's restoring the entire world. He's repairing everything that the sledgehammer forces have smashed out of the together wall, you know? This is the beginning of his kingdom, and we now live with him in it. Come abide in me, he says. It's a new social community, a new way of life together with Jesus. Ordinary service to people that helps them enter God's peace, God's shalom, his rest. And so now a closing question. Did you catch what Peter's mother-in-law did right after she was healed? And I don't think I mentioned this before, but her burning fever was a common sort of ongoing. I might have said this. Gosh, I don't know. But it was a chronic problem, right? So she was suffering from it for a while. And she's been sick, therefore, for a while. So you put yourself in those shoes. You're bedridden. You're sick. You've had a terrible fever. You're crippled by this ailment. And now you're completely well. You're totally healed. What is your first move? Well, yeah. She wants to go for a swim in the lake and just stretch out and relax, go for a jog, do some personal thing, and get some of the things that have piled up done. You know, it's been forever. I got to get a bunch of... There's nothing in what she does after she's healed that suggests self-serving. And I don't mean, I'm not going to go down that road of like, don't take care of yourself. You don't matter. You know that's not the teaching of Jesus, and it's not, never been the way that we teach here. But what you do see is an immediate change, or not change, I guess. Well, yeah, it's a big change. She goes from being sick and bedridden. Jesus heals her. Her first move is to serve, diakoneo. Mark says that immediately, he throws in that word, I think it's euthys, immediately after she's healed, she begins to serve others. Sometimes, and we see it as a sense of serving food or waiting tables, and I think that's at play here, but I think Mark often will speak in that, John does this too, the gospel writers do, you're saying it one way, but you mean it even bigger. So there's like, yeah, she's doing that there, but the first move she makes is to start serving others in the broad sense. Notice how Jesus gives her a gift and it changes her. So she's saved by a gift, which in the first century, gift and grace, same word. So she's saved by grace. And in her renewed life from that gift, her instinct moves toward giving goodness to others, offering a similar kind of love as a gift. Just like the grace she received. Isn't that beautiful? So kids and women and men, this is our Christian way of life. It's to serve and to love. It's never to power up, try to control, try to master over others or have authority over other people. It's always to invite people to see how living in the authority of Jesus has helped us find healing and continues to every day, and to just see him and participate. This is one of the most crucial moments in the story, I think, because it gives you and me some big instruction. Jesus is going to teach more about this later on, this idea about serving. One who serves others, one who ministers to others or cares about the human beings they meet in life. And he teaches about it because he's dedicated to life. Tov matters more than anything, and in the life God created, it is good. So later in chapter 9, for instance, it says they're having a conversation in chapter 9 about Jesus, who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom, the most powerful, the most important? Me, right? I hope. And in verse 33, then they came to Capernaum. So notice they were out away. They were on one of their missionary or ministry jaunts or whatever. And then Jesus was inside the house and he asked them, what were you guys talking about on the way down here? But they were silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. They're like, what? Nothing? We didn't say nothing. And after he sat down, he called the 12 of them together and he said, listen here, peeps. He didn't say that. He said, if anyone wants to be first, he must be last of all and a servant of all. Okay? So 9 chapters, by the way, that's a good bit later. The dull disciple motif is still alive, and they are like, who's going to be the best? Who do I get to control? And Jesus is like, in this kingdom of God, it's about serving, caring for others above yourself. My kingdom is the total opposite of that power structure, who's in charge, who submits stuff. That is not the way that it works. It's not the way Father, Son, and Spirit work. It's not the way the world is created, because Father, Son, and Spirit create the world. Not long after that scene, then James and John are still asking, so we get all the way to chapter 10, and they're like, who gets to be in charge later in your kingdom, huh? Verse 41 of chapter 10, when the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant, you know, so they're kind of bummed, you know, they're like, come on, guys, pay attention, don't you get it yet? Verse 42, so Jesus called them together, and he said, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and the officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, so he's talking to people who are his learners, people like you and me, people who want to live in the kingdom of God. But among you, it will be different, he says. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. Okay. Well, you see that in Peter's mother-in-law right out of the gate, don't you? She receives the gift of healing from Jesus, and boom, she's like, let's take care of people. It's beautiful. in the average world, unfortunately, our pop culture American church world, we have leaders and rulers who claim authority over others all the time and try to lord it over them. They're not part of the people. They don't care for the people, don't serve the people. They just make the rules and execute them. I've literally heard people say that. That's what we're here to do. Make the rules and not execute. Enforce. Oh, man. You know, we have other authorities. This study proves that you must think and act this way or you're low and bad. That's a big authority in our world, and it wields over us. You've got to believe it or else. You don't want to be on the wrong side of history, our authorities will tell us, you know. And, of course, they're always on the right side and even God's side, will some say. And they wield that over, you know. If you're not with us, then you're going to be low and bad. And it's just not the way the kingdom works. Because in the kingdom, if goodness matters most, then the kingdom people care about goodness more than who's in charge of what, who gets what, who has what, what's fair, what's not fair. They just care about what's good for people. And they see themselves as able to provide limitless, endless love to each person that they come in contact with, whoever comes across their path in life. It's a goodness lived and taught by Jesus about healing and teaching with true words and silencing the demonic voice that corrupts us. Only Jesus has authority, exousia, or is in charge or is calling the shots, and he tells us what to do. So we follow him as our authority. There is authority in the world, you bet, but it's Jesus. You and I are shoulder to shoulder, brother, sister, mutual servants, learning his way together. And this is how everything that has been corrupted in the world will eventually find renewal and restoration. This is how every evil spirit gets cast out. This is how, I think, this is what the scriptures are teaching us, goodness is restored. A scholar and a friend that I studied under, Scott McKnight, writes this in a book that he recently put out. He said, pursuing greatness is not tov. A life in service to others is not heroic. Rather, it is ordinary people helping ordinary people who happen to be in their path as they travel through life. I think that first line, pursuing greatness, is not tov, you know. It is so important as we move forward as a church, as a whole body, that we're never hoping to become some sort of great thing. That we're simply looking at our lives each day and our neighbors around us and saying, how can I be good to you? And I would ask, how do you feel about that kind of mission? Because I think before COVID, there was a tremendous amount of energy and enthusiasm and adrenaline around becoming great. We could do it, the next great thing. And it's like COVID has blasted a lot of any of that, certainly out of me. I think out of our culture in a big sort of cannon blast way. And I think a lot of people truly are like, I want to get my feet on solid ground and know who I am and actually start to become alive, because this has felt like a lot of death. And I don't really care if something's popular right now or not. I want something real. I don't know. I don't know if you're feeling that, but I sure am. How do you feel about that kind of mission? And I ask all listeners for sure, but a special invite to my Eastside crew. How do we feel about living ordinary lives and helping ordinary people until we die? Not in any way pursuing something through the lens of what will people think is really good or really impactful, something that's really enough to make a big difference. And we literally let go of that and we simply say there's a tremendous miraculous power in not following that social way of ordering life and instead seeing who we're in the presence of life with and living with goodness toward them, doing the best we can. I tell you what, I like that idea, but in this context in Portland, it will never be seen as enough, according to the just popular social world. You know this without me telling you. It won't be regarded as something that's really doing enough to matter. Ordinary does not get big results. We need to be doing more, always bigger, always greater. And sometimes, all the way back to the beginning of this podcast, sometimes that desire to be greater, which was built into us by our own world, we read into this text. But when we sit in the context, again, you see it's actually the opposite of that completely. Jesus's work is tov. It is good. Ordinary, helpful goodness toward his neighbors. And he's teaching his guys how to do it too. And the women that he's working with too. Mary from Magdala. Magdala is just around the bay, you know, from Capernaum. And there's a whole nother story there about her and the possession of a demonic spirit and Jesus casting that out and becoming one of his closest friends and most devoted disciples. And not because she wanted to become great, but for the same reason Peter's mother-in-law starts to serve. She wants to serve and love, and that's being a part of God's kingdom. Dallas Willard said that there's a well-kept secret about the peaceful, ordinary life. It is made to be a receptacle of the divine, a place where the life of God flows. The well-kept secret about the ordinary life is that it's made to be a receptacle of the divine. That's where you receive the divine life of God, where his life flows in that way. So just, I hope you can feel that. And maybe that can bring great relief, because sometimes COVID sort of has brought us down and dreams of this or that greatness can't happen. And maybe what we have to just do is let go of it altogether. So let's just give up on anything that looks like greatness and instead embrace goodness. Friends, as a church, we're a team of people, brothers and sisters living mutually together in service of others. Nobody greater or lesser than anybody else. And Jesus, our only true authority, teaches us how to serve one another. And so when voices say that that's not enough, we still press on with Jesus and say, no, it is. And we trust in his way of serving, diakoneo, this service of our life for others, the sacrificial life. It's another way to talk about the cruciform life. We use that word sometimes. A life that's formed by the cross, that sense of giving of who we are to other people to help bring shalom and peace. It's certainly the way of the disciple and therefore the way of the church. I mean, they're like capital C church, but certainly then therefore our local church. Trying to live each ordinary day in the shalom of God. So the ordinary rest in a permanent way, if you will, where we see that goodness matters most. Because that rest is restoring us to the goodness we were first created in. And it has begun. We wait for it. I totally want it to be finished yesterday. So do you. We all do. But we need not fear. Because Jesus is with us. He's with us now as we work to bring healing and teaching, preaching about his kingdom. And silencing and doing away with or casting out the cursed voices that destroy us, those demonic spiritual beings that wreck us like sledgehammers. We must go on to other towns as well, says Jesus, and I will preach to them too. That is why I came. And so he traveled throughout the region of Galilee, preaching in the synagogues and casting out demons. Father, Son, and Spirit, we pray. Please heal us. Please form us together again in your true words and lead us not toward any sort of greatness, but into the mutual, ordinary Sabbath life with you, Jesus, where goodness matters most. Amen.